Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who until last week had never thought about using a vagina as a cash point. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much, but now I've thought of it and I can't get it out of my mind. Hello! Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging around with Andy from... Andy's Dinosaur Adventures, mainly CBeebies based, the people I hang around with these days, because I have 2 children. He's also in Andy's Prehistoric Adventures, which is not as good. Thank you. It's the biggest misuse of time travel technology there has ever been, what Andy is doing in those Dinosaur Adventures. I believe I'm talking to an audience of people who don't watch CBeebies, but I'm playing to an audience at home who are fucking killing themselves at this. Just go back 5 minutes, Andy, and don't break the thing. That's my takedown of Andy from Andy's Dinosaur Adventures. He calls it Rahalastapa anyway. I don't know if that's going to catch on. We're going to crack straight on because I have to get a train back to Hertfordshire. And it's my guest this week. Not as good as last week's audience, I've told you already. He's probably best known as DJ Resplendent from Treks and Flipside. Might have been and the Flipside. He's also, of course, in Channel 4's Does Doug Know? That's why we're all here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Reginald D. Hunter! I hope. Is he coming? He's playing a prank on me again. I mean, pranked. He has a slight mobility issue. He's Reginald D. Hunter! We're going to have to do this bit twice as well. Here he comes. Hey! Welcome. Come sit down, please. Please sit down. Reginald D. Hunter, how you doing?
Hey, man, probably better than I deserve. How you doing? Thank you for having me. Hey,
it's my pleasure. It's my absolute pleasure. As I was saying, but I'm trying to get in touch with you for a while to get you on this. I'm delighted you are finally here. Do you remember much about DJ Resplendent in the show from Treks and the Flipside?
Yeah.
What was that?
That was
that's what you're best known for.
My British acting debut.
Okay.
And thank goodness not a lot of people saw it.
One of the first times I saw you do stand-up is when it was an epiphany for me as a stand-up. Right? I didn't do much stand-up in the 90s. I did a bit and stopped, and then I came back in the early 2000s and started doing stand-up again.
Came out of retirement.
Out of retirement and came back. I got rid of the Deadwood and came back on my own. And you've been holding me back. And I saw you in a gig down in that Great Portland Street Station, that little pub downstairs.
Yeah.
And I'd done the first half, and I was very much doing scripted stuff. I was quite early back. I was doing 20 minutes, and it was all quite scripted. And you were a bit late, and everyone had to wait for you. And then you came down the stairs, and we kind of got into your bit, and you were meant to do 20 minutes, and you probably did an hour. And you just sat down on the stage and just seemed to talk about what had been going on in your day. And it didn't seem like stand-up at all. It was very funny, but it felt like it was a totally improvised
Sometimes
story.
You gotta be careful with British people. They might be insulting you, but it sounds like a compliment.
Well, A, you were sitting down. You sat down. You came and sat down. And, that blew my mind. I thought stand-up, you had to stand up, so that was the first. But I saw you do this, and you just talked for an hour, and everyone was rapt, and everyone was just having a lovely time. And I just thought that's a matter. I thought I would love to do comedy where I don't have any idea what's going to happen. So in a way, you created this podcast. Eventually, I'd just come on stage, and we'd talk, and we'll see what happened. Do you remember that gig? I mean, did you do that a lot? Was it scripted? Do you remember when you were doing stand up in 2004, 2005?
Yeah.
Or would you just come and chat?
I was in a phase in my career.
Yeah.
Where I was, I was trying to sound natural on stage. And I got a friend, he's a comedian, and he struggles with being funny. But but what he do is he come on stage, and he comes on stage and he just start talking. He starts his stage performance like he does a conversation.
Yeah.
He'll walk up to a group of people and be like, "Hey, yo, I was parking over there," and so I'm like, "Yeah, I'm gonna try some of that."
Yeah.
And it does make your set rather lengthy. And so but I remember that phase.
Yeah.
Before serious white people started paying me. Serious white people like you to observe time. And so
but it was like a proper, all those, occasionally you have gigs that stick in your memory, either your own or of other people's. It's just one of those, and I just thought that's, because I just felt like I'd been so, I'd done okay, but I'd just been, so restricted by what I was doing. And then it's just totally free, and it was just so relaxed. It was just unbelievable. There was no effort to go, hey, I'm going to go for the punchlines, but you were making people laugh all the way through as well.
During that phase of my career, it was really lovely, man. You go on stage, and I would have a taste of beverage while I went on stage. And if you're doing real good, man, the bar would just start sending taste of beverages up to the stage. And then you'd be like, well, this must mean they want me to stay. And I remember I did it one night, man, and just, oh, it was terrible. I pissed all over myself. And you know, British audiences, they'd be like, "Yeah, it's real, it's raw." Go.
So unusually, you got into comedy. You were training as an actor. Mm. You came from America to England.
Yeah.
To train as an actor, which is it usually works the other way around in England. Is that the black actors all go to America to become successful?
Yeah. So I figured there were some vacancies over here. You know, that technique of going where the work used to be. And
but is it true you just got into stand-up sort of almost as a bet? Did you have a bet?
It was more of a dare. Yeah. I was in this pub in Birmingham, and I had just lost my pantomime job. Long John Silver. And I'm sitting at the bar, and I've had a taste of beverage or two, and I'm kind of ranting a bit. And I'm ranting, I'm talking out loud, and about 10 people in the bar, and they laughing and giggling. And one person says, "Hey, man, you should do the stand-up." And he points to the sign and says, "Stand-up every Tuesday." And I was like, "Yeah, man, maybe." And I was like, "Maybe." And I called the guy that ran the gig, and I said, "Hey, man, I want to come do some stand-up at the show." And he says, "You're a professional stand-up?" I said, "Never done it." And he said, "You funny?" I said, "That's what I want to see." And he said, I don't know. You American? I said, yeah, that help? And he said, come on down and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
And I got on stage and I wasn't in love with stand-up to start with. So, I mean, if it hadn't gone well, you know, I'd done something else. But yeah. It went better than I anticipated. And I thought, man, I found something I'm pretty good at that's legal.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of comedians probably have that sort of epiphany in some way, you know, in like, I'm going to give this a go. You've got to make that first leap. But that, it's, you know, that's
it was kind of a lark, you know. Yeah, yeah. Be like, if nothing else, I can tell my grandkids one day, yeah, one time I do some stand-up in England.
And so did the design, you were still trained to be an actor. Were you at RADA or?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So that's like a... That's a big school to get into as an actor.
Oh, yeah, that was all right, yeah. But it was somewhere near the end of my term there that I realized that there wasn't a whole lot of black roles in Shakespeare. And it was a year after that I started realizing I probably wasn't going to play James Bond. And so, yeah, but I was supposed to be here like a year or so. And I just kept staying.
Yeah.
And just every day it was something new. Somebody would say something that I didn't understand. Or it was English, but not the English I was familiar with. And so, yeah, it was nice.
And
ride.
So you've been here for like, 25 years?
Hey, man, 20. This year.
Yeah. 20 years. Yeah.
I mean, that's, I don't know that's... about you sometimes.
When are you going to go? Just you know, go back. We don't like foreigners over here anymore. Would you like to go back to America in the current... You must go back, obviously. You've got family over there. But how do you feel that America's going at the moment?
Well, it's been a while since I've been back.
Is it?
Yeah. I stopped going when I saw that shooting niggas was back in fashion. And... And that never really caught on over here.
No.
And
so, not in the same way. We never. But I'm delighted you've decided to stay. I have to say, you mentioned that word then that
shooting.
Yeah. But it's sort of weird, isn't it? You've kind of got into a few situations where you've used. That word, the word nigger, I'm going to say it because it's the word we're talking
hey,
about.
Hey, baby!
it sounds so much better when I say it, is what I mean.
Look at you pulling out the bigness.
And you got into, I mean, you named a lot of your shows with that in the title, and then you did this corporate for the footballers.
Yeah. Yeah, that went famously awry. No, I had a girlfriend about 10, 15 years ago, and we just got to playing around, you know, and we started to add and niggas to titles.
Yeah.
So we came up with, like, Finding Nemo and niggas. The Lion King and niggas. And so we kept messing around, and I finally came up with a show called Pride and Prejudice and niggas. And a lot of people got upset about that.
Yeah.
Mostly Jane Austen fans. It's a surprising pissy little bunch, man. And it's just part of my vernacular.
Sure.
I mean, where I come from. I was in Georgia. My daddy got sick about 4 months ago, and I had to dash back to see him. And I was getting his mail out the box, and I heard the soft male voice behind me say, "Excuse me, sir, may I please ask you a question?" And I turned and I looked, and it was a young black boy, about 19, sleek and beautiful, 2 minutes darker than midnight. And I looked at him, and my heart was already touched because he had said, "Sir," and "please." And I felt this well of pride building up in my chest, like, you fucking right. In my part of the world where I'm from, we still teach young people how to respect adults. And I said, "What can I do for you, son?" And he said, "Have you seen a bitch and four niggas walk past you?" I swear to God, that happened.
Yeah.
And I said, "Son, there's a much more elegant way of saying that, but They went that way.
But it's something that's interesting that, I mean, because usually it's, you know, if a white person uses that word, then they're in trouble. I'm going to be in trouble, aren't I? But if a black person does it, that's...
I know. And that's okay. White people invented the word. Yeah. I think in this country that's called irony.
But it's sort of weird that you've ever gotten in trouble. The football one was sort of weird.
We call it getting in trouble, man. But getting in trouble, getting in trouble is like some middle class people get mad at you and don't come to your show. You know, they don't drive up to your house and shoot your family or nothing like that. I mean, that's trouble.
Well, let's talk about your family a bit, because I think you've got 8 siblings, and you're the youngest, but you're a lot younger than some of them. You've got quite a lot of grown-up sisters when you were born.
I got a sister that's pushing 71.
Right.
And the youngest to me and closest to me in age is 10 years older. She's 58.
Right. Working at that.
48 plus 10.
That's a trick. You say you're the 4th funniest person in your family.
Yeah, that's true.
Who are the 3 funnier than you?
My dad was number 1 for years.
Yeah.
He don't slip to number 3 because he's kind of old. And then there's my sister. I probably take a little of each of them on stage with me every night. My sister is a great mimic. Okay. And she has a great sensibility. And then there's my nephew Chauncey. He did he's a military. He did Iraq and Afghanistan. He got blowed up real bad over there, survived, came back, and developed a sense of humor.
Right.
Which you gotta kind of have to. I remember my oldest sister, the one that's 71, I went home and I bumped into my nephew and he was mad with her. He says, "Let me tell you about your motherfucking sister. Let me tell you what she do. She'll walk up to you and say some old sideways shit, and while you responded, she will just walk the fuck off." I said, "That's rude." And I said, "Well, you have to remember, you know, she busting 70. She survived breast cancer. And when you survive breast cancer or any type of death situation, it just automatically turns down the volume on whatever niggas are saying to you." And he said, "Yeah, that's true. But you know what? I got a friend. He has third-degree burns all over his body in constant pain. But when you go to visit him in the hospital, he is still fucking polite."
Well, your dad gives me hope, because your dad was 50 when you were born.
Yeah.
And I'm 50 and my second child just
was
born.
Hey, baby!
So I'm hoping I might still live to see them get to be 48 years old.
At least the sperm still work, though, doesn't it?
That's no work.
Yeah, my sister told me, I have a completely different relationship with my father than my other sisters and brothers, because when I came along, when they were small, he was out in the streets. And gambling, booze, chasing women.
Yeah.
But when I came along 50, he was slowing down a bit. So he...
Very much the same.
So... I heard about you in the streets. Casino Richard. But my sister told me, she said, "Daddy had his first child when he was 19. But he only got interested in being a father somewhere around 50.
Right, yeah. Well, I think that's... If that had happened to me, I would think I'd been saying... It's so difficult. That's such difficult... If you don't have kids yourself, do you?
I just started having sex last year, so...
Yeah. Do you think about... I mean, I know you say... I've seen you talk about it in interviews, but is it something you are thinking about, having a family, or is it something you've discounted?
Well, if I'm honest, excuse me, I have a 16-year-old daughter.
Okay.
That I met her for the first time last year.
Okay.
I didn't know of her existence previously. And she don't have any of my facial features, but she has every bit of my nature. She wants to understand everything. She feels like she can, and she asks endless questions. I remember the first conversation I had with her, she says, "I have a bit of a heart murmur, and there's no history of heart disease in my mother's side of the family. Tell me, how do people in your side of the family tend to die?" I said, "Gunshots and fatness."
Well, that's pretty incredible. So that was a that just you found out about your daughter last year?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, okay.
She's a big slice of all right. and we took to each other pretty quick.
Cool. Oh, that's amazing. Cool. Oh, that did well.
So
then.
There's that.
We do that, hadn't I? it's like a Stephen Fry moment. That is. I'm very pleased with myself. What I love about you, and which we're already seeing, is just the kind of quality of language and your use of language and the kind of poetry within the way you speak. It's just sort of so phenomenal.
Well, see, where I come from, everybody sound like me, right. Especially the women. But it was only when I was over here, when I got over here, that I sounded poetic to people, as you said.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Most of my family have never seen me do stand-up.
Right.
And after I first started getting, a lot of notices and stuff like that, I go back home and my family would just look at me and you can see them staring at you. Just, they'd be like, he don't seem no different. Just sitting up here talking junk and farting all over the place. White people over there must be crazy. It's funny, but it's not a joke.
And there was a nice quote from your dad. I read you were talking about saying that men are quoting Solomon and the Bible and saying that men brought down by vanity. You were talking about vanity.
Yes. My father is functionally illiterate. He left school in the third grade, but he's a master. He's 98,
yeah.
So it's hard to get that far and stay dumb. And he loved his favorite stories in the Bible are Samson and King Solomon. And he told me once, he said, several times, he said, vanity has brought down more great men than any pursuit of money or vagina or booze. He said, vanity leads to all of them things.
Yeah.
And so I keep a lot of friends over here in England because English friends keep you grounded. They make you feel like you never left the ground because they treat you like dirt. And so, yeah, I try to keep the vanity in check.
Yeah.
And but what was weird was when I got over here, there's a strand of vanity or arrogance that you don't find much in America. Over here, they have intellectual arrogance. I just finished reading this book. I'm going to go to this party and make people feel stupid.
And do you think that's part of the success, do you think, is to do with you having this kind of outsider's eye on, because you've come from a very different world to this world now, and you've got this outsider's eye, I think, still, even though you've lived here for so long.
It's funny the breaks we give people subconsciously. Like I get early in my career, I caught a lot of breaks because I would say a word like nigger, and then people always go, oh, he's American. And I remember about 4 months ago when I broke my leg, I'd be on stage, and if I forget a joke or if I fuck it up, all I have to do is go, and then people would go, he's so brave.
Because you're still on crutches.
Yeah.
So that's quite a pretty
serious
break.
Yeah, I left
him
backstage to appear more manly.
Yeah. And what did you do? How did you break your leg?
I started touring this year, early May?
Yeah.
And the early version of the show, I had Michael Jackson tribute section. And I was doing the moonwalk. And and I felt something, felt like it kind of broke. But I kept going because I'm true to the game. But then when I felt that second break, I thought to myself, well, I must not be doing it right. No, seriously, I was... What happened was, I was on my off night of my tour.
Yeah.
And I was in my flat. And when I'm touring, there's always stuff on the floor, like overnight bags, gym bags and stuff. And I was on the phone with my ex-girlfriend. And we were arguing. We've been arguing ever since we broke up years ago. And the truth of the matter is, we both miss and kind of want to fuck each other again, but don't want to admit it because we got a lot of pride. And it kept... So she said some old crazy shit. So I can't remember what it was. But I was stepping over a bag going into the bathroom. And I was like, what the fuck did you do? And I was going down. And you know, there's a moment when you're going down where you're like, I ain't going to be able to rebalance this. I'm going down. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll make sure I turn and land on my back. That way I won't bust out my teeth and nothing like that. But I had forgot that at the time I was kind of fat. And I didn't have my usual agility. So I got broken in two places. It's a twist break. And yeah, it's very unpleasant.
And how did that affect the show? You had to stop touring, or did you carry on touring?
Oh, no, no. I was in the hospital room, and the white people who make money off me, they was in there. And they was acting very concerned, you know. They were like, oh, Reg, you hurt your leg. But every time they say something, you could hear the undertone of, so we're going to have to cancel the tour? And, but yeah, it's a blessing in disguise. It actually made me slow down on stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, just and enjoy every word. And I regained a sense of command on stage. And so, yeah. And plus, when you're sidelined, you see areas of the game that you don't notice when you're playing. And so it's, yeah.
Yeah. What I love about you as well is you're very thoughtful about the craft.
Man, for somebody I never really spoke to that much, you seem to love me a whole fucking lot.
I love you. I don't like to socialize. I'll only have a conversation with people if there are cameras on me. That's how it works. But you know, you really think about the craft of what you're doing. So you're very thoughtful about that, about how comedy works. There's another thing you were saying about how comedy is all about tone.
Mm.
And you know, you're saying horrible, shitty things as a comedian a lot of the time. And you sort of see that. There was a great Aziz Ansari, who I really love, was doing accepting that award with the BAFTAs. He won the BAFTA, and he was just saying all these terrible, horrible things about BAFTA and how he'd flown over to America, even though he'd been in Scotland. And he was, you know, talking about the food, and it was awful. Anyone else saying it, we'd have gone, that guy's just so rude.
Yeah.
And yeah, but everyone was laughing because of the way you were saying it. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's not, when people take a thing out, a line out of context or a joke out of context, then you just read it. You don't get the human behind it.
Well, so I do, I mean, in comedy, I think in society in general, but they've been in comedy for years. There's a group of people, I call them outrageous, and they're constantly outraged. And it's like my mom used to say, it's one thing to misunderstand something, but it's a whole other thing to go out your way to misunderstand something. And so the people who take things out of context, they're looking for that. So,
yeah. And I think most comedians will get that at some point, and you've had that at different points where people are. I mean, people, you know, you are inviting. I suppose you're inviting people to come and critique you if you're doing stand up. And
yeah, but I've never understood, like, after you do a set.
Yeah.
And if I ain't like it, then you know I just leave and go. I don't like that. I mean, I don't think I'm gonna check him out no more.
Yeah.
But I don't hang around until you come outside to tell you I don't like that, man. I don't like that.
Well, that's why, again, with Twitter, it's become even more so, hasn't it? So someone will kind of tweet, go, I mentioned Dave Gorman was coming to the podcast, and someone then replied to us both going, oh, he's not funny. Kind of going, well, you know, I think he probably will live with the disappointment of you not liking it. But it's a kind of weird thing to, you know, to tell him personally. So, you know, that's what you're sort of dealing with, is this sort of...
I mean, I remember I did a gig in Exeter years ago. It was like 300 people in the audience. And there was this one lady who just... She just got real irate. And she came up and she was like, that it's just not funny. I said, so them 299 people laughing, that don't count for nothing.
It's true. Well, and I think that's, I do a bit in my show about how we, you know, we, as a comedian, you're assessed every single second of your working day. People might get assessed once a month or every year in their job. Every single second of our job. And the moment it's not going that well, is, you know, it's assessed. We know how we've done basically every gig anyway. We don't need an individual opinion because we know, as a comedian, you know exactly how well you've done on that night.
You have to have your own system that you judge yourself by.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what kind of keeps you balanced. Because I've come off stage and people thought, that was great. And it just, I mean, it might have been great compared to the other motherfuckers you saw on stage. It wasn't all that. And then, but at the same time, you know, it's like, you know when you've done well. And it might, you know, Tony Woods once told me, he said, a comedy club sometimes is the worst place to do comedy.
Yeah. I've heard a great story about you, which I hope's true, was when you were at the... I want you to take over this story, so I'm just going to try and give you enough information to see.
Okay.
When you were working...
Do you love me in this one?
I don't love you. Oh, I kind of like... I think this is cool. In the Pleasance... In the Pleasance... I think you were playing the Pleasance, maybe the Pleasance Grand, and there's no toilet in the venue. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I kind of do. It was a comedian. Was it Andrew Bird?
I can't remember who it was.
I ought to be ashamed to tell this, but you brought it up. There's no bathroom backstage at the Pleasance Grand. And so it's about 15 minutes for about 10 minutes before I go on. And there's a plastic pint glass, and it has about that much beer in it. So I relieved myself. I was taught to survive. And so I'm doing sound check when it's not my turn, and Andrew Bird comes up and he goes, "Frank Spencer, did you piss in my beer?" I said, "Well, that little bitch, if you hanging on for that, man, I don't know." And he said, "I just drank from this." And I said, "Well, calm down. You're gonna be funnier than you ever been for about 3 weeks." Don't panic.
It's such a funny line to come up with. Oh, good. So that's all I care about. I only saw this story in one place. I'm quite interested in this. That when you were 18, you were accused of shoplifting. Is this true?
Yeah. God damn, I'm told all my business. Yes.
I used to shoplift all the time. I never got caught.
Yep.
I'm like the Jack the Ripper of shoplifting.
Oh, sir, you're white like us. Take what you want. Yeah, I got caught shoplifting, man. And my mother and I, we loved each other, but we didn't like each other a whole lot. She's very strict, disciplinary, very Christian. But she fought tooth and nail. I remember sitting in the lawyer's office. And the lawyer says to my family, it's my dad, my sister, and my mom, he says, "Well, Mrs. Hunter, I think that Reginald has good grades and he's never been in trouble before. I think I can get him on what's called a pretrial motion. And I think we can go ahead and see if we can get the judge leniency." And she says, "Let me tell you what I know. I know this is my baby. I know he didn't do this. And I know I want this to go away. Do I make myself clear?" And it went away. It was one of them southern backroom pay some money kind of things.
All right.
Yeah, my mama knew about all that. And and about 5 years later, I was sitting up watching a movie with her, Casablanca, and she was rolling up her hair and she says, "Ooh, I do love a good Humphrey Bogart movie. They don't make them the way they used to." And just, "And what in the fuck made you steal all that stuff 6 years ago?" And I was like, "You knew?" She said, "Yeah, nigga, I knew."
But did you get a job with the lawyer that acquitted you?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I have to think that this was another part of my mother's intervention.
Right.
I have a feeling that she probably went to him and she says, "I know I want him to work for you." But his name was Carl Bryant. He's the one who turned me on to Rumpel of the Bailey.
Right.
And he took it upon himself to teach me how to be a gentleman. And that's the part that made me think my mama had something to do with it.
Sure.
She's like, "Teach him how to not steal shit."
So how long did you work it with? For him?
I worked for him for 2 years.
Did you?
Yeah. And great man. He died about 10 years ago. And he did a case, a divorce case. I was with him, and who was in deposition, and we were representing the lady. And he just kept rolling his eyes during the deposition. And so I talked to him afterwards. I said, what's the matter? You don't respect this lady? This is our client. And he said, this is the third time that she's brought action against him. And every time she pulls out. And what you come to discover is she doesn't actually want to divorce him. She just wants to put him on trial.
Now, you told us that Trump wouldn't win the election. You were quite
frankly, man, I'm embarrassed by that. I feel that British people should punish me and not listen to me for a year. But I mean, at the time, though, we couldn't understand all the machinations that was behind Trump. You know, just all the analytics, all the funding, and just so yeah, very embarrassed by that. I mean, on multiple fronts, very embarrassed.
And your latest show, which I think you might have just finished it, you're saying you're going to do some more of these, some people versus Red and
Russia. Yeah.
So based on the O.J. Simpson, well, that's where it's coming from, the O.J. Simpson program, the People versus. So what was the show about?
The show was about some people that I've had battles with, on social media, family members. I got a brother, my middle brother, Oliver. We like each other. No, we don't like each other much. He thinks that I'm spoiled, entitled, and things just come a little too easily for me. And I think he's a Christian prick. And see, what it is, me and him very competitive. He's my mother's favorite child. And I am my father's favorite child. And since mama died first, I won. Sometimes life just comes down to the horse you chose to back. But that O.J. Simpson thing, man, I'm embarrassed. I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but that documentary came out last year. Was it Made in America?
Yeah.
And I watched it like three times. And since 94, man, in my mind, I was trying to hold out for O.J. It's like, because I related. I mean, just, you know, black dude around lots of white people. They like him. And just how could his ego not just... But I was looking at that from 94 to like last year. I was kind of rooting for O.J. I thought, well, you know, the glove and, you know, just you know, racism. And just... But I was looking at that documentary, and I swear to God, for the first time, I thought, that nigga did it. God damn! This nigga did it. And so, yeah, just he just got out recently, and I ain't saying he's been punished enough for what he's done. I ain't saying that. But for OJ, I really want him to go somewhere and be quiet and stay off of white people's minds.
Well, that documentary was like incredible about. I mean, America is so fucked up.
Imagine if somebody did a documentary that were four parts about you, and the first three parts was intricately explaining why you fucked up.
Yeah.
There's something creepy and merciful about that, I think. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that people, and we're seeing it again, people are built up and then knocked down, and often for good reason, and often the success and fame go... The vanity that you were mentioning and goes to their head, and they start believing that they're above the law and above everyone else.
But I remember when I left home to come to England, my mama hugged me and she said, "Take a good look. You're looking at the last people left on this planet who love you enough to cuss you the fuck out."
You see, your mother, the relationship with your mother is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, it is.
Oh,
it,
yeah, I guess.
But you clearly, you know, as much as. You had a hard time with her. You obviously, there's a deep love there as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, she was violent in her words, slightly less so, but just formidable enough in her physical actions. She was physically violent. I remember a few years ago, I was dating this lady, and I was waiting in the living room with her, and she came out the room like whips and chains and stuff. And I said, no, thanks to my mama, I'm good with that. I'm good. But yeah, she came up hard and just she just didn't trust things, you know. Just she trusted Honest Label, she trusted Christians and just
yeah.
And just she didn't like none of this coming to England. And when I became a stand-up, I remember I bought her a television. I mean, bigger than anything I would have for years. And it's purely psychologically, please accept me, Mama. Please, just please forgive me for going to England and not finishing college. Please forgive me, Mama. And she looked at it and she said, "You bought that with that stand-up comedy money?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." "That ain't no kind of job, standing on stage lying all the time." "What you gonna do when you run out of lies? You gonna be out of work then." And I said, "Well, comics who lie on stage, Mama, when they run out of lies, they steal lies from other comedians, Mama."
Yeah, good. I'm gonna like this as well. It's a nice description of comedians, but you travel the world a lot. You're performing all over the world. You said you were part of an order of traveling monks. So there's a kind of religious tone to that as well, though.
Jedi joke monks.
Yeah, but that's, you know, you found this nice sweet spot, I think, haven't you? Where you're very well known in the UK, and you do really well touring here, but you can also tour around the world. You play America and go all around.
I haven't done America that much.
No,
I mean. Like, over here, you could go, you know, fuck the queen. And half the audience would be like, "Yeah." And you do that in America, man. We're like, "You don't fucking like it, buddy." it's just really, it's really odd, man. I remember when I, in the late 90s, when I started, I went to New York. And just, I was at the Comedy Store. And it was like 16 comedians on, just a deluge of comedians. And just the things that were just openly racist and sexist and homophobic. I saw this black comic come out on stage and he goes, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I hate? Faggots. Don't you hate faggots? I just like women. You know, I don't like faggots." And the audience was cheering and everything. And it's like, oh, man, I'm glad I live in England.
It's, well, I found that when I went to, like, I've never played America.
You know what I'm afraid of? I'm afraid that somebody's going to take that excerpt from the show.
Oh, definitely. That's all it's going to be. Oh, no. We'll be going, Reg, please, calm down.
They're going to wait 10 years when I'm trying to run for president, and the I hate faggots bit's going to come.
But that's why when I was in Montreal, even last time I was in Montreal, the first time I was in Montreal was in the late 90s, but I was in Montreal in 2007 and seeing a lot of American stand-ups, and yeah, a lot of women doing, "Aren't men all, men are all like this, but we love them," you know, and just going, "Fucking men aren't like, you know," they were going, "Aren't they awful, bullshitting liars, but we love them," and you go, "No, we're not, and you shouldn't love them if they are," and all the, you know, anyone coming on doing an ethnic character would be just,
"I know,
my parents, they'll do it, my parents, so it's all right, my parents are like, you know," and then just do the...
I remember I was in Atlanta at a local club, and it was like, the audience was half black, half white, and there was this white comedian on, and he says, "I just came from Nova Scotia. A lot of beautiful people there, but black people couldn't live there. Not because you can't, black people can't stand the cold or can't survive, but chicken wings, $8 a pound." So I looked around. To see if other black people was upset too. And they were like, "No, we sure do love chicken wings."
Yeah. So, do you think that kind of view, do you think there's always a place for that, where it's just the sort of reinforcement of stereotypes? Is that always going to be in comedy, or is that something that...
You laugh at what you laugh at.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's got to be places where people can go where they can laugh at stuff that maybe we don't laugh at.
Yeah, yeah.
And in America, it stands to reason that America was born and steeped in racism. So it stands to the reason that some of the ways we commune and get together is over racism. It's part of the American DNA, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. It is it's a fucking fucked up country. And I say that fucking being in Brexit UK.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to point that out.
I'll ask. I don't, it seems a waste to ask you emergency questions, but I'm going to.
I shall appreciate it, man. I'll listen to
Okay. I'll ask you. What's the strangest thing you've ever found in the embers of a bonfire? Popular question. He's not seen a Bigfoot. I asked him backstage, and I thought there was a good chance he would. What's the strangest thing you've ever
backstage
found?
Backstage, and he was asking me this, and I was like, man, don't ask me nothing like that. I have yet to root through the embers of a bonfire.
Have you?
Yeah, I've been meaning to do it every year.
Yeah. Do you enjoy celebrating Guy Fawkes Night here when you're over in the UK? How do you feel about that?
I've never really celebrated. I would usually be home somewhere and I'd be like, "What's that? Something burning?" it's an odd holiday.
It's a very strange holiday.
Yeah, it's just. But I mean, you know, British people seem to be happy, so I'd be with you.
Well, I took my I mentioned this last week, but I took my 2.5-year-old daughter to the fireworks display, and she just went, "It's too loud. My ears hurt." This is a weird thing. It's a weird thing to do to kids to make them with their lovely senses be bang, bang, bang. We're all deaf now. Okay, we can carry on. It's good, you know. It's good that we've got a healthy tradition of celebrating. I'm not even sure what Guy Fawkes Night's really celebrating. Is it the attempt to
overthrow your government?
Is it saying that it's good that they didn't do it, or we wish they had done it? I'm not. I think it survived because it's ambiguous enough. You can both sides. It's basically Christianity, isn't it? You can make whatever you want of it.
I mean, if they're celebrating the potential overthrow of the government or the man attempting to overthrow the government, they should have a softer attitude towards terrorists.
Yeah. <It's true. laughs> I'll try. I'll do a Christmas moment. They do Christmas
just
in America.
Can't fucking resist, can you?
Backstage, I asked if they have Christmas in America, and they do have Christmas in America. So we're going to have some fun. Do you have? I asked you some stupid ones backstage, and I don't want to do that. Do you think Christmas might have been invented by mulled wine salesmen, desperate to find an excuse to get rid of a warehouse full of little muslin bags full of weird spices? That's not a good question to ask. That's a joke. That's just a joke. That's a joke. What is the funniest fart you've witnessed around the Christmas dinner table?
Did you say the funniest fart?
Yeah, the funniest fart. The funniest fart I did, my mum, if you're watching this, that I ever saw, my mum's a very well-to-do and polite.
If you don't mind my saying, I feel like I'm just present while you intervene. So.
I'm going to ask the best for you to give you time to think about it.
All right.
She made a lovely dinner, and she's a very well-to-do, lovely, nice, softly spoken 75-year-old lady at the time she was. And then she stood up to take the plates away and did a fart, and it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I mean, you had to be there. Because it was my mum. You can listen again now, mum.
I remember I was telling somebody the other day, a friend of mine, she was angry, and she was going to post something angrily. And I said, you got to be careful about doing that, because... things that you write and say today, they hang around.
Yeah,
it's like a fart that you do that just never disperses. Don't go in that corner. My dad farted over there in 1982. It's still pretty rough over there.
Well, that's a strange thing about comedy, and we're sort of seeing that, you know, in lots of different ways. But like you, it is now, things are recorded, and comedy tastes will change, and you'll do, you know, people will do something in 2007. We're talking to Simon Brodkin about doing a character where he's slightly blacked up, and you might not do that now, but then that's still there on the record. You know, it's kind of an odd thing that if you're getting judged by, you know, just things you've said 20 years ago, and especially if you're saying them in a... And that's it's the context, again, when it comes out of context. When I did all my old shows, I did them all in a 6 weekends, you kind of think, God, there's things I wouldn't, you know, if now there's Twitter and someone could just take that line and go without the context of the whole show, you can...
Sometimes I look at stuff I said years ago, and I think to myself, how did I find the nerve to say something like that? I don't know what I was going through at the time that made me think that was all right.
Yeah, well, it's true, and you change your own mind about your own stuff. And so how do you feel about, you know, you're approaching 50, I've got to 50.
Yeah.
And it's not good. How are you feeling about getting older?
I don't really have a whole lot of self-esteem issues wrapped up in my age. You know, my dad's going on 100.
Yeah.
And I remember he was sitting at the table. He was feeding the dog from the table. And my sister walks up, and she gets all ballistic. And she's like, you know, Daddy, the vet told you don't feed him from the table. That'll give him heartworms. And Dad said, he my friend. I eat steak, he eats steak. Fact of the matter, He says, dog was eating something on this planet well before dog food. And so she started to go at him again, and I said, hey, do you realize you're talking to a nigga who remembers when dog food came out? When it was the newfangled thing. They're making food specially for dogs.
And so are you looking forward to getting older? I mean, I think as a comedian, it's kind of interesting.
My point I was making is that, I seen how he handled old age.
Yeah.
And just, I come from old people. I was raised by old people in the heat. And so, it's just, my dad still likes to sip of moonshine every now and again. And to my surprise, he sees a hooker like once every 3 months. And I asked him, I said, are you serious? And he said, yeah. I said, how does it work? He says, well, I'm almost 100. Sometimes it go up, sometimes it don't. But if it don't, she real sweet girl. She don't charge me nothing. And I said, just because you old? My mom's dead, by the way. So that's
fine.
There was a look of grave concern on this woman's.
Well, it's kind of nice to think you'd be 98 and still get erections at all, isn't it? I think they've gone for me.
Yeah, how old is your last child? I may get sensitive about it, but also, my family stopped celebrating my birthday around 9 years old. And so I'd be on stage sometime and I'd be like, shit, it's my birthday. And so I think there's good and bad with that. But I think the good that comes with that is it makes you less self-conscious about aging.
Yeah.
You know, I wake up in the morning and check and see if everything's still working. If it do.
Well, it's good to get older. It's better than not getting older, isn't it? People keep dying now at the moment, which is, and younger people keep dying. People are, our age are dying, and it's it makes you think a little
bit. I used to think years ago, it's like, because it was only when I got to England that I noticed women talking a lot about aging and, don't match me my age. And I used to think, man, I was noticing that younger and younger people were getting weird about, oh God, I'm turning 30 next month. And I just thought, man, eventually you're going to see a couple of 9-year-olds. And one's going to be like, I can pee by myself and tie my own shoe. But I don't know what it means because I just see the big 1-0 staring me in the face.
Well, it is. I do every 10. Well, I've sort of done this every 10-year show now about getting older. And you kind of think, I did one about being 40 and being upset about being 40, and I'd give anything to be 40 again. I would like to go back, So, you think, oh, this is bad, but you get older and you go, oh, you missed the. You've lost.
I bet you've had fantasies of doing shows when you're dead, and dead ain't fun.
I have had fantasies. I've had fantasies of creating a hologram of myself to do a show about being dead and after you're dead. I think that would be good if you write it and record it. That you can still tour after you're dead.
Yeah. Don't forget to make it funny.
I won't. All right, I'll ask you another emergency question to get out of that. I don't think you have. Have you ever appeared on the TV show Sunday Brunch? I don't think you have. You should go on it. It's good.
I am. I mean, you really asked a tough question.
I do. All right, this is a good question for
all
you.
Right.
Would you like to have a bath with my dad?
Well, I think, like most people, yes.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Do you want to know more about him or just happen to say yes?
I'd like to know what kind of bath water he like, because I'm very particular.
He's 81. He's just had an operation on his leg, so you've got somebody to talk about.
Yeah, okay.
And he's in the bath. He's all right. He's quite a nice guy.
Yeah.
He wouldn't touch you or anything. It wouldn't be inappropriate.
Yeah, I'd just ask him, why are you sound so fucked up about aging?
Question. I'll put that in my next one. Okay, I'll ask, this is a good question.
Yeah, that's what you said before.
You like this one. If your genitals had to turn into a sea creature for one day every month.
I can already tell this ain't good.
Yeah. But you can choose the sea creature. What sea creature would your genitals manifest into on one occasion every month? I like to cover all the bases in this. It's been some touching stuff about family, and then also sea creature genitals. You've got to do something for everyone. I demand an answer. Don't help him. And that's a bad choice.
Yeah, don't help me cheat.
Don't have to answer.
I sure appreciate that. I really appreciate you not making me answer that.
That's okay,
hey, how much time we got to be together?
I've got to get a train.
Yeah,
home,
oh
so.
Man, yeah. You realize if I went back to the ghetto with these questions, I'd get killed.
Well, I'm going to let you take that hard back, and then you can give it a go. No, it's been amazing to talk to you. We will have to wrap it up, but it's what's coming up next? What are you going to do next?
Oh, I'm still trying to find a flat, but I've kind of loosely made the decision that after my last work is done for the year, I'm going to go somewhere for a few weeks, a couple of months. And I'm going to get lean again and see if I can rebuild my leg and reclaim my great speed.
I think it's good. It's good to... it's hard, I think, as a comedian to take time to yourself, do you think? Because you've got to keep working because you feel you have to, but also you've got ideas coming. It's really good to take some time away.
And, you know, when you take it... Do you have that thing where, like, when you haven't worked for a while... You start feeling like, you know, others are gaining and you're losing your thing and you don't know what's happening. And
a little bit, yeah. And also, you just become shit at doing the job. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. You come back 2 months afterwards and you just can't do it anymore.
You know, if you haven't been doing it for a while, you're used to speaking to one person at a time. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
So I got... after I finished my last engagements this year, I'm not professionally obligated till February. And so I'm gonna go somewhere and I'm gonna get off smoking and become unfat and
let's go together, Reg. Let's do you and me together. Let's do those two things together.
You gonna bring that book?
It's really gonna. Ladies and gentlemen, Reginald D. Hunter. To Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, who this week was Reginald D. Hunter. Thank you for the people in the band Pest who played their musical instruments to create the soundscape over which I am talking. Thanks to everyone at British Comedy Guide, everyone at Leicester Square Theatre, everyone at Go Faster Stripe, and everyone who knows me at home and all my friends and family. Thank you. I am indebted to my producer, Ben Walker, and this is a Sky Potato Fuzz on GoFasterStripe.com production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me? Like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.